We are giving. Hello, welcome to the Mind Report. My name is Lori Santos. I'm a professor of psychology at Yale University, and I'm speaking with...
Dan Ariely. I'm a professor of psychology and behavioral economics at Duke University.
Excellent. So today on the Mind Report, we're going to be talking about cheating, why we cheat, what makes human cheating unique, and some things we can do to stop cheating. And for those that don't know, Dan has written a fantastic book about human cheating. I'm holding up my iPad version here, called The Honest Truth About Dishonesty, Why We Lie to Everyone, Including Ourselves.
You know, now that you've said something nice about me, I think it's worthwhile mentioning that social niceties is probably one of the main areas in which people cheat.
Well, maybe Dan can tell me if I'm lying about how fantastic his book is, but I thought it was good. But why don't we start by, Dan, just tell me a little bit about kind of what got you into cheating, because for a long time you'd studied human irrationality, but this is... The book, at least, was kind of your first foray into cheating.
Yes.
So why cheating?
So I think cheating on a few grounds. First of all, it turns out it's just a wonderful, interesting irrationality on its own. The second thing is that, much like other irrationalities, it's something we don't understand very well. So if you ask people what drives cheating, the usual model that comes back is the cost-benefit analysis, or a version of it, even if people are not economists. And they're saying, well, you know, people think about what do I stand to gain, what do I stand to lose, is it worth it? And because this is the intuitive model, this is also the model of policy. So if you ask policymakers, what do you do to prevent bad behavior? They say, have high punishment. As long as you have high punishment, people would behave perfectly nicely. But guess what? Mm-hmm. In our data, we don't find it, but also in the macro data. If you look at something like the death penalty, the National Academy of Sciences had a paper recently in which they looked at the efficacy of the death penalty. And you could say, well, you know, some states have the death penalties and some don't. Stands to reason that the states that have the death penalty, nobody would commit any crime that could get you that punishment, because, you know, it's such a severe punishment. You can't think about the worst punishment. But nevertheless, there's no observable difference between these two types of countries, states. Now, you know, it's not random assignment, it's not great experiments, but the fact that there is no difference suggests that this theory, people think about the cost, they think about the benefit, they make some calculation, is not correct. So it has huge implications. And then finally, I think that because of the financial crisis, we need to kind of realize where this honesty is coming from, and we need to figure out what are our next steps. And, you know, I think that this financial crisis is an outcome of bad incentives, not an outcome of the housing bubble. I mean, the housing bubble was a symptom, it's not the cause. And unless we fix the cause, I don't think we're going to get much better. And, you know, one last thing. Cheating is really interesting. We all do it. We all do it at least a little bit. And trying to understand what's driving it is incredibly interesting.
Right. So it's not the cost-benefit analysis. People aren't thinking about, like, how bad am I going to get punished if I do some negative thing versus how much I'm going to gain. So what is it? What are some surprising things that drive cheating?
So first of all, the first surprising thing is that people are not influenced by the cost-benefit analysis. So in our experiments, we mostly tempt people to steal money from us. They're usually small amounts of money, a few dollars. And you could say, what happens when we increase the amount of money that people can steal from us? Turns out nothing. What happens when we decrease the probability of being caught? Turns out nothing. What emerges is all about rationalization, right? So think about rationalization as a machine, as a balloon. Every time rationalization goes up, people cheat more. Every time rationalization goes down, people cheat less. And what it basically ends up being is that people are trying to do two things at the same time. We try to look in the mirror and feel good about ourselves, feel that we're honest, wonderful, kind people. And we also try to benefit from cheating, at least in the short run. And you could say you can't do both. You could do one or the other. You're either honest or think of yourself as honest, or you're dishonest. You can't do both. Well, turns out that thanks to our flexible cognition and rationalization, we could do both. How? As long as we cheat just by a little bit, we can think of ourselves as good people, and we could cheat just by a little bit. And that turns out to be the issue. And now the question is, what controls this rationalization? And I'll just give you kind of an intuitive example. In the last 2 years, every time I go to a restaurant, and I don't remember, Laurie, if I did this when we were together or not, you tell me, I asked the waiters if there's a way to eat in the restaurant and escape without paying. And I basically said, look,
no,
I'm not going to do
it. I wasn't with you when we didn't do that last time.
We didn't
I was together.
Okay. Yeah. Next time. I said, look, I'm not going to do it. I'm just interested. Like, if you're going to recommend for me a method, what would you recommend? And, you know, sometimes they're suspicious. Sometimes they ask for my credit card. Sometimes I reassure them. But in almost all cases, they have fantastic recommendations. There's a back alley. There's a bathroom. Wait for a big party to come. They have really good ideas of how to do it. And right. then I said, and how often do people actually do it? They say, almost never. And they said that from time to time, somebody forgets to pay, but then they walk after them, and they didn't really run away. They just kind of forgot because paying with credit card is so effortless that we sometimes don't remember if we paid yeah. or not. Now, contrast this with something different, illegal downloads of music. And I'm sure that you don't have any illegally downloaded music on your computer, and I'm sure none of your undergraduate students have, but, you know, some people, so I hear,
right.
have that. And you ask these people, how do they feel about it? There is no guilt, there is no worry, there is nothing to it. Now, the probability of being caught is also not high in that particular case, but it's not the probability of being caught. It's the fact that there's no guilt connected to it. You can't go to a restaurant, get a server, consume food, feel that you're consuming some marginal cost from the restaurant, take it and not pay and not think that you're an evil person, right? I mean, you might do it, but, mm-hmm. but you would think that you've done something wrong. Illegal downloads, there's no feeling of bad feeling, no guilt, no remorse. It's not connected. And that's basically kind of the issue. And imagine that we can take this activity and change something from being guiltful when it's eating in a restaurant to guilt less in the illegal
yeah,
downloads. And I think that's basically the path that we go through in banking. That's what corruption is about. There are some activities
we
feel guilt about, and then this guilt goes away.
So what are some of the things we could do? So in the restaurant example, I could see a couple of things from your work that suggest we're not going to rip off the restaurant, right? One is that we're kind of being supervised. At least the waiters are going back and forth. There's lots of people there, right? Most of my undergrads, when they're doing illegal downloads, are probably by themselves in their room. Nobody's watching them. So how much is supervision important for getting people to think in terms of not cheating?
Yeah, so we find that supervision can help if there's a negative social stigma associated with it. But but there is not negative social stigma associated with activity. Having other people watching you doesn't really help. In fact, sometimes it can backfire. So, you know, if you think about somebody like insider trading, I've talked to some people who are, have been accused of, actually convicted of insider trading. And what one of them told me, Garrett Bauer, he did insider trading for 17 years. At least that's what the government said. And he said that he has not met a trader on his floor that did not do insider trading. And now ask the question of how bad do you feel when you do insider trading?
Mm-hmm.
And he said that he always felt that he got worse tip than other people. He said other people would get this incredibly precise tip. IBM is going to do this. They're going to buy this. They're going to sell this at this price and so on. And he said his tips were so general and not specific, he always felt like this was not really insider trading, that the real insider trading was tips, not what he was doing. So this was the case, and he not only that, he said that sometimes somebody would get a call and all the brokers would get around that to listen more carefully.
Mm-hmm.
That's not an environment in which a supervision would do anything. And by the way, it's also not the case that he didn't know that this was illegal. There's a difference between what we know is illegal and what we feel bad about. And what we feel bad about is what's controlled by our social environment.
Right. And so this is suggesting that one of the things is about the social norms that gets us not to cheat is just what other people are doing, right? And the insider trading example you just said had two features. One is this guy saying everybody's sitting around doing it. And then the second thing, which is that this guy's not doing it as badly as everybody else, right? Like
that's
his
right.
tips are just kind of general, but everybody else is doing it worse.
Yeah. And the second thing also, I also talked to a guy who took drugs. He's a cyclist, a very good cyclist. And he said,
I hope you're not naming names here.
No, we can't name names. But what he told me, it's not Lance Armstrong, but when he was out of the out of cycling for a few years. And he said when he came back, he was still in shape, but all of a sudden everybody else was cycling better. Mm-hmm. And he said he took EPO, he took this drug that basically increases the metabolic ability for oxygen with red blood cells. He took this drug to get back to his rightful place. Not to get ahead, but just to to stay with everybody else.
Yeah, and this actually hits on some of the spots where we're seeing cheating being really rampant, right? Not necessarily in the case of like illegal downloads where like you're just kind of doing it for your own benefit, but cheating in the context of these kind of competitive situations, right? So as you probably know well, my alma mater, Harvard, just convicted over, you know, I think it was like 200 some odd students of cheating on this one take-home final exam, right? And this is a spot where kind of like the cycling example, these students feel, if you think other students are doing it, then you think that you're going to be worse for the fact that you're not doing it. And so that kind of, not just that other people are doing it, but that because other people are doing it, it's going to put you at a disadvantage. That seems like a special case when the it's not just the social norm, but it's also in some sense like the rational process of how you might get better by actually cheating.
That's
Is that the kind of thing you see in the empirical work as well, not just in the example?
Yeah, absolutely. So when we give people examples of other people from their social circle cheating, they cheat to a higher degree. If it's people not from the social circle, it doesn't increase. But if it's people from their social circle, it goes up. But there's another interesting thing about the Harvard case, which is that I actually think that for students, it's very difficult to figure out the boundaries of cheating. And here's the thing. You know, I'll tell you a biblical story. So there's a story in the Bible that God comes to Sarah. And he said, Sarah, you're going to have a son. And Sarah laughs. And she said, how can I have a son when my husband is so old? And God said, don't worry, you'll have a son. By the way, this is my version of the Bible. It's not exactly written like this. And then God goes to Abraham.
It's an Arielly Old Testament. Go ahead.
Then God goes to Abraham and said, Abraham, you're going to have a son. And Abraham said, great, what did Sarah say? And God said, Sarah said, how can she have a son when she is so old? And God lied. Sarah said, how could I have a son when my husband is so old? And God said, she said, how could she have a son when she is so old? And the biblical scholars have worried. They've kind of wondered, how could God lie? And their conclusion was, it's okay to lie for peace at home. In Hebrew, it's called shalom bayit. And that's an amazing justification and rationalization if you ever want one. But I talked to all kind of religious leaders about it. And what they said was that there's lots of human values. Honesty is one of them, but only one of them. And what do you do with some human values collide with other human values? Which one wins? So there is this approach that says, you know, if the somebody comes to your house to look for your friend and you know that they want to murder them and your friend is hiding in your house, you should tell them. Because you never know what the lie could lead to. And this is kind of the Kant approach. There's the other approach, which I think most people hold, that's saying, honesty is one human value, but we have many others, and they're not always compatible. Now, here's the thing. In the social domain, we all understand that lying is actually good in many cases. You know, think to yourself, how would you like to live with somebody who's perfectly honest with you all the time? Honey, how do I look in the dress, and so on, right? You probably want a little bit of fudging the truth to make you feel more loved, more attractive, more successful, and so on. And we all understand that in the social domain, a little bit of dishonesty is a good social lubricant. But now we move to the business domain, and now we don't want that. Now, for most people, we have this separation between the social life and the business life. In the case of students, this is the most overlap you can imagine, right? There's basically nothing, almost nothing is different for them in their social life and their professional lives. And I think because of that, creating the boundaries of where is dishonesty acceptable and not acceptable is particularly challenging for them.
Yeah, and I think the student cheating example gets to another thing you were just talking about, which is this conflict of values, right? So on the one hand, I think all those Harvard students knew that being honest and doing the work yourself is a kind of virtue that they'd like to uphold. But at the same time, I think that being the best and having good grades and all of these other, and competing with everybody and sort of staying above the Joneses and all those things, I think those things have come in as values for students in much more profound ways than they have in the past. And in some ways, I feel like those competing values might be kind of eroding the virtue of staying honest. Is that going to fit with what you've been thinking?
I think absolutely. And if you know, we did a study. We asked people to become the CEO of a bank. And they basically played the computer games in which they were CEO of a bank. And what happened was the bank made some money, then the bank got to some not-so-good period. And now these people had a chance to do what's called revenue enhancement. Revenue enhancement is the professional code name for screwing your customers. It's about, you know, holding checks for a few more days, increasing ATM fees, increasing penalties. There's an industry that of consultants for revenue enhancements. And in one case, we told the CEOs of this bank that their main goal is to maximize shareholder value. In the other one, we didn't emphasize this one ideology. And guess what? The moment it was about maximizing shareholder value, all of a sudden it was incredibly easy for them to justify all kinds of other things. And they basically engage in much more revenue enhancement and much more devastation to their customers, but they did make more money. And if you think about it, this is the case of kind of an ideological bent that you have. Something you want to justify. You want to justify a high salary and high bonuses and because you get paid by stocks. And if you can find an ideology of why this is okay, then it makes it easier for us to be dishonest.
Right. And this, I think, gets to one of the many things of why human cheating might be different than the other cheating we see in other animals, which is not just that we rationalize, it's that we have the kind of culture and the kind of mind that can build up rationalization, not just in our own head, but set it up as ideology as part of, say, a firm or a culture or a university or a generation in terms of getting better grades. In terms of how to make people better, are there things we can do to attack the ideology?
Yeah. So, you know, first of all, I think that the comparisons to animal is really useful to remind us that we're actually quite good. Right, so we're talking a lot about how people cheat and how terrible it is and so on. The reality is that people don't cheat as much as they could. The reality is that people don't cheat as much as they would if they were rational.
Right.
Just think about yourself, right? Think about the last week. Think about all the possibilities you had to steal something and get away with it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You go to restaurants and they probably have very nice silverware. And, you know, you could probably take some of it and put it in your purse and nobody would find out. You probably have been to one of your friends' homes and they might have some really nice CDs and DVDs. And when you went to the bathroom, maybe you could have taken one of their towels. There's all kind of things we could do almost all the time without being caught. And nevertheless, we don't take advantage of these things. And this is where we're actually good. And, you know, we talked earlier about this deterioration, that you start by having a moral code and feeling bad about bad behavior. And then if nobody's behaving nicely, over time it can erode and erode and erode until eventually you have no bad feelings. You have no feeling of regret or remorse or embarrassment and so on. The fact is that when you get to that position where you don't care, now you're perfectly rational. Now you think just about the cost and benefit. And my understanding is that in the animal kingdom, it's just the rational part. It's really much more about the cost and benefit, and there's not much else in there.
Yeah, and that's, you know, the surprising thing is that the animals are pretty good at doing an analysis on cost and benefit, right? In the benefit case, so take cases of cheating in the animal kingdom in terms of infidelity, right? You know, these pair-bonded birds that go off and have copulations. I mean, one of the things that evolutionary biologists remark about is that, yes, there are a lot of species that get classified as monogamous, but very few of them are actually monogamous because most of them are out there having what biologists call EPCs, these extra pair copulations. But then you ask, okay, what controls
whether... It sounds so nice. EPC sounds like a good term for that.
You have to kind of, you know, make it not seem like the birds are doing all these nasty things. But but they're doing very rational nasty things, right? Like the females, there's work suggesting that female birds are actually calculating how much benefit they can get from, you know, being in another male's territory if they sleep with him, right? It's fully calculated, And it doesn't, even in cases where they're not getting caught, it doesn't seem like they're thinking about it in terms of them being a good bird or being a good individual. Same thing in the monkeys, where we've been doing stuff on stealing in the monkeys, giving monkeys these, just like you guys do with letting the undergrads steal money from you, we let the monkeys steal food from us. What we see is that it's perfectly predicted by the cost and benefit. You know, if they think they're going to be seen, they just don't do it. But if the value is high enough, then they actually steal from us.
Yeah, and also in the monkeys, right? If a monkey who's lower on the pole finds food and they know they can eat it without anybody seeing them, they have no problem.
That's right. As long as they think nobody's watching. I mean, the coolest example actually comes from a recent paper by Franz De Waal and his colleagues. He was doing this study where capucha monkeys were being nice to each other, and so they had a chance to like give other monkeys food, right, and kind of donate it out of the goodness of their heart. And what Franz found is that monkeys are actually surprisingly nice when everybody's watching them. But as soon as you put the subject monkey in a situation where no other monkeys can see it anymore, it actually becomes very spiteful. They deliberately choose the mean thing as soon as somebody's not watching them.
Yeah.
And the claim would be like, if you put, you know, you can put people in these anonymous dictator games, which is basically the same thing, and people don't show the same phenomena, you just feel bad about things.
That's right.
And so I think this is, I mean, being a psychologist who thinks about why humans are special, this is a sort of funny puzzle about humans, right? On the one hand, we have this psychological system that doesn't want to look like a jerk, and that makes us be far more nice than would be rational.
That's right.
But on the other hand, we also have a mind that's ready to rationalize so much that we can kind of do crazy things to override the system that's trying to tell us to be nice.
That's right. But the nice thing is to realize that what's making us nicer is our irrational side, right? Mm-hmm. So this is a case where you said, should we fix irrationality? Should we get people to do more of the cost-benefit rational calculation when it comes to dishonesty? The answer is no.
Right.
We should get people to be less rational. And, you know, and the animals are much more rational, especially when they're not being watched, and that's not something we want to thrive for.
Right. And so do you see these cases of kind of increased cheating and increased plagiarism and stuff like that? Is that a case of people becoming more rational? I mean, or is it just a glitch in the system of we're setting up structures that allow us to rationalize, or setting up social norms that are make it easier?
Yeah, I think it's not that the individuals are becoming more rational. I think it's the systems allow higher rationalization. So, you know, think about plagiarism. If you think that everybody is doing it, why shouldn't you? Recently, I got an email from a woman in Greece who said that when she bought her house, she didn't pay any taxes. And the person who sold her the house didn't pay any taxes. Now she's selling the house. Now the office and want her to pay taxes. She said, why now? Why not wait 6 months and then start taxes? Right? Like, why is tomorrow going to be different than yesterday? Why not just delay it for another few years? And the same thing about some of the websites that help students get essays, right? There's a website called eCheat. And the tagline used to be, I think they just changed it, but it used to be, it's not cheating, it's collaborating. You know, you basically create these mechanisms that allow people to do things by thinking less about them, make them more standard. Or there's another website that helps people find alibis for affairs. And it's an incredibly detailed website. It's amazing. You can get fake flight tickets and hotel receipts, and there's numbers that people can call and find out that you're actually in a conference. Like, the whole thing is incredibly orchestrated. I don't know how expensive it is, but it seems incredibly... Now, the fact that the website exists and the tagline is for real people in the real world, and you have all these testimonies from other people, probably give you the impression that this is incredibly popular, right? Lots of people are doing it.
Well, this raises this interesting question about, you know, what our responsibility is, right? You know, as social scientists, we've long known that, you know, telling people that everybody's doing something, kind of giving this descriptive norm, kind of slightly makes people more likely to do it, right? And it kind of raises the question of if journalists and maybe science writers have responsibility for this stuff. I mean, you just wrote a book that, you know, how many people have read now that suggests that 98% of people in the right circumstances
at least,
will
at least
cheat,
my mother right? read it. But yes, you know, I think this is actually it's a real problem, and I can tell you that I got a call from the honor committee in a school that I will not name. And the honor committee told me that one of the students that was coming up for an honor violation brought my book as evidence that everybody else is doing it as well, so why should he get punished?
Mm-hmm.
And thankfully they didn't take him too seriously, but I think it's actually kind of an ethical, interesting question, right? If
right.
by telling people, and that's not just science, it's the media. Every time we have a story about how many people are cheating, it basically loosens people's morality to some degree, make it easier for them to cheat a little more, right?
And if this... I mean, look, the front page of the paper today, when we're having this conversation, is about, you know, high-level people in government who are having serious affairs that now get public and, you know, end up on the news. It's about whether we're having cheating by certain parties, of having voter suppression and messing with voter boxes. Like, I mean, I think if you look at the front page of the paper, all you see are cases of people cheating and doing bad things, right?
Yeah.
So much is the media to blame?
And after looking at that, you say to yourself, that's more reasonable to do. That's the bad side. The good
mm-hmm.
side, which is, I think, is also our responsibility, is to say if we understand the extent of the problem, maybe we'll do something about it.
Right.
Now, if all we did was to convince people that everybody else is cheating and therefore it's
mm-hmm.
okay, then it's a terrible world. But if we do some
right.
things to make people realize what the pitfall this is, maybe people would become more careful.
Yeah. And this raises an empirical question I'm not sure your group has data on. Do we know what happens in terms of cheating after you tell people about these mechanisms? I mean, I know we know that if you tell them, look, everybody's cheating, 98% of people are cheating, that it could potentially make them worse. But what about if you tell them, I mean, do we know that people who read your book think differently about cheating? Do we cheat less if we know the mechanisms of cheating?
So you know, I don't know about other people who read my book. I think the same thing could say about
right.
you know, people who read my first two books and understand some things about human irrationalities, are they now better shoppers, they think better, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
I will tell you what I'm doing personally. And there's two parts to it. One is that I'm much more careful in terms of the rules that I give myself. Right?
Yeah.
So I realize that I'm my own enemy in terms of dishonesty. And it
mm-hmm.
would really be good to have some very strict rules about what's acceptable and not acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
And you can think about all kinds of domains. You can think about what do we do with, whoops, what do we do?
Mm-hmm.
My room just went dark. I have this,
uh-oh.
No, but I have this sensor. I haven't moved enough for a while.
You want to pause and wave your arm?
I am, I just waved. I'm back.
Okay.
So one thing is to say I have more strict rules for myself in terms of data collection, experiments that work and don't work, and taxes, acceptable receipts, not acceptable receipts. Once you understand the dangers, you can be more careful with yourself, and I think it's about rules. The
mm-hmm.
second thing is that understanding dishonesty is actually a huge burden, I have to say. So
mm-hmm.
part of it is understanding that good people can cheat a lot and still think of themselves as good people.
Right.
And it's about conflicts of interest. So, you know, the last time I went to my dentist was not around. There was another woman who was changing him. And I had
mm-hmm.
a cracked cavity at the back tooth on the left side. And she said it needed to be replaced. And she suggested porcelain.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, is porcelain better than amalgam, better than the silver? She said, oh, yes, yes, much better. Now, I gotten into lots of trouble in the past with dentists because I've said all kinds of nasty things about dentists, almost
mm-hmm.
all are true, but
yeah.
I kind of had some serious fights with dentists, and because of that, I've been reading stuff about dentistry.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, that's interesting. I didn't tell that's interesting, but I said, oh, can you show me that porcelain, is there any evidence that porcelain is better than amalgam? And she said, well, you know, it's getting much, much better. I said, yes, but can you show me any evidence? And she said, well, I don't have any evidence to show you, but it is getting much better. I said, you know, first of all, it might be getting better, but it's not better, right?
Mm-hmm.
And said, if you don't have any evidence, why are you recommending this? Because it, as far as I can tell, it doesn't last as long, mm-hmm. and it's more expensive, and it can break yep. more easily. Why doing it? And it's in the back tooth. If it's the front tooth, maybe you can argue for aesthetic purposes. Not that, you know, in my case, it wouldn't really matter that much. And then I said, you know what? I'm going to keep on coming to this practice because I love my dentist, but I never want to see you again. I didn't say three times. So I just never want to see you again. Yeah. And I think part of it is that my understanding of conflicts of interest mm-hmm. keeps on resonating in the back of my mind. I keep on thinking about how other people might be susceptible to conflicts of interest, and I'm willing to take the extra step. Now, it's a very tough step. It's a very tough step to go to somebody and says, I don't believe you are trustworthy because your incentives are not aligned with giving me good advice. But I think it's incredibly important.
Yeah. And I think that this keeps coming up, like, all over the place. I mean, one of the other spots that this keeps coming up is even in my own research, right, where you know, we want to find the truth as scientists, but there are also incentive structures set up that if you get a particular kind of result, it could mean one kind of paper and another result not, right?
Yep.
And so there's this question about, like, how much social scientists should be putting incentives in place to actually make things cleaner, better, whatever. And so in our own research, we've been trying to think about, like, okay, what are the ways that we can get people to do this? I mean, one is that we've started having students code data that aren't the person who's going to be an author on the paper, mm-hmm. right? So that there's no incentive in place to potentially actually get the result that's not yours, coding things like doing blind coding and all this stuff. But, I mean, I think there's this worry that in the social sciences, the incentive structures are getting tweaked around such that truth isn't the only incentive in science anymore, but also like getting good papers and getting grants and so on. I mean, have you guys run into this stuff? Are you putting incentives in place for your own lab to increase honesty?
Yeah. So I think everybody's becoming more aware of it, right? So it's basically mm-hmm. not about bad people. It's about good people who find creative ways. And I think, you know, we have this problem of what happened to experiments that don't work. What do you do with them? I think there's a question of sometimes data selection, that some people decide to include and not include some data. And what I tell my students, after personal experience with this, is that you can have whatever criteria you want. No old mm-hmm. people, only people understand English, no drunk people, whatever you want. But you have to do it before the experiment, and you have to be explicit about it.
Right.
And really trying to shift the focus from getting a result to doing an interesting study. And I think there's a question of how do we create that? How do we create the idea that when you find something, you learn something, regardless of the results, fit the literature or don't fit the literature, fit what you thought before mm-hmm. or not. And with funding, it's particularly challenging, right? So mm-hmm. I'm thinking about the scenario in which, so I have a big lab. I have about, about 20 people work here. Mm-hmm. And at some point, I got the news that I'm going to lose some of my funding. It never happened eventually, but I got the news. And I really kind of panicked because there were, you know, lots of people depending on me for their salary. And all of a sudden, some of their funding is going away.
Right.
Now, this is not my case, but I can imagine that if this was a biology lab, for example, and we needed some pilot data to get a new grant, or even a big psychology lab, and we would need a pilot data to get a big grant, we would think differently about what are the criteria for something to be reasonable pilot data.
Yep.
Because all of a sudden there would be this pressure, and the pressure is not really for me, it's for these 20 people who are working for me that will be without a job.
Right. Now, we know from some of your work that that's a worse pressure, right? If you're doing it on somebody else's behalf, if you're cheating on somebody else's behalf, it can be better than
that. That's right. Now, in my particular case, you know, I went after, I basically expanded my scope of searching for money. I was actually a little bit too successful, so now I'm amazingly overwhelmed.
Now you're rich, yeah.
I have too much money, but also too many obligations. But I think it's a... Again, you know, we understand that the funding structure in Wall Street is not ideal. Mm-hmm. I think the funding structure in science is not ideal too.
No, right? Agreed. So, and I think that one of the things we've been trying to do in our own lab is like to try to balance that by just in the social norms, like increasing the incentive structure for truth, right? Like, so in my own lab meetings, we've banned talk about good results or bad results or interesting results or not interesting results. Whenever I hear that sort of normative version of the results, we nip it in the bud and I say, no, that's not what we want. We want truth,
yeah.
Right? You know, so an incredibly silly thing, but I think this is another feature of kind of the human norms, right, is that we can set them up really easily with the kinds of words that we use, right? I mean, you talked a little bit about this already with some of the websites, right, that like real people are doing it.
That's
or
right.
This is the kind of thing, you know. And so I think not everyone realizes some of the importance of these subtle kinds of changes that we can do to make things better.
Yeah, and you know, this happens, of course, we understand it better in science, but I had an interesting call with somebody that runs an incubator for startups.
Mm-hmm.
And startups are basically in the business of presenting data to investors. And they have absolutely no rules about how to present data. Right?
Oh, wow.
What is a user?
Mm-hmm.
And what is a sustainable user? And how do you think about it? And how do you plot your growth? And so on. And what they're doing is they have an incentive to see the world in an extra rosy view.
Yep.
And they shade things. You know, they don't go out and do crazy stuff. But within the constraint of what they have.
Right.
They find the most rosy version. Then they get the investors to buy into it. But eventually now investors don't believe them anymore. There have been too many of those things with too many rows. And now it's bad for everybody. Now the investors are trying to guess by how much they're exaggerating, and they have to exaggerate even more. And it's really a very bad cycle. Now, if you think about it, a coordinated effort is incredibly helpful for everybody. If the entrepreneurs would decide about what are standards, everybody would be able to invest better.
Mm-hmm.
With the uncertainty, everybody is suffering. And that's actually something incredibly important about trust, is that trust is a social good. If we all trust each other, we're all doing well. And, you know, we don't need to lock our cars and hide our bank accounts and so on. The moment trust is eroded, everybody mm-hmm. suffers, right? So right now, lots of people don't trust the banking system. So lots mm-hmm. of people who lost money in 2008 took the money out, did not enjoy the return of the market, and now probably can never retire.
Mm-hmm.
The moment you have trust in society and somebody is taking a bite out of their trust, we all lose. And so it's incredibly important about how do we become a society we trust and how we don't deteriorate to society that just looks like a society of corruption.
So maybe it'd be fun to end on if you could come up with, you know, three practical tips for how we could make society more trustworthy, or even pick your tinier example. What would the best three tips be?
So, three tips. So I think mm-hmm. it's very hard to get people to be moral in general, but I think reminding people about morality at the point of temptation can do wonders.
Mm-hmm.
So just before you're tempted, some moral reminders, professional reminders, and so on are incredibly important. The second thing I would say is that we are creatures of habits rather than creatures of deep thinking. So if we can create some good habits, that would be a second thing. And third, I would say that something like a Day of Atonement is a good idea. Something like the Catholic Confession. That sometimes
Is there a good secular way to do that? Or
I think there is a good secular way. And sometimes we start misbehaving, and if there's a way to open a new page, that's very important. And there are opportunities for opening new pages. We have New Year's. We had the Reconciliation Act in South Africa, where a whole group of people stood up and said, these are the awful things we've done during apartheid, and we're going to stop. And I think you can think about renewing your vows with your significant other. I think you can think about all kinds of cases about saying, okay, you can think about amnesty programs with the IRS. There's all kinds of things we can say, okay, we've misbehaved, but we really want to be good. Let's start fresh. And what are these mechanisms we can create for ourselves, for our companies, for society? I think that will be my third direction.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Well, I think we are almost out of time. So let me thank you, Dan, for providing some insight into human cheating.
My pleasure.
And we hope to see you all again on the Mind Report. Thanks so much.
Bye. Bye-bye.